Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This is coming to you just a few days after our last episode, and that's for a good reason. Google I.O. 2021 kicked off yesterday, Tuesday, May 18th, and we are going to talk all about the jam-packed keynote. There was Android 12, there was Wear OS, there was a lot of pie-in-the-sky stuff, including a quantum computer that I want Jerry to explain to me in detail, because Michael Pena did not do a great job. So, starting us off, Alex Dobie, welcome back. How are you doing?
It's good to be back. Yeah, 2 weeks in a row. It's unusual, but yeah, good to be back. Good to be talking about Android 12 and all that good stuff.
We'll keep the bribes coming, and we'll have you back for a third week in a row.
Yeah, almost like you're paying me to do this.
Ara Wagner, how are you?
I very much wish I was at the Magic Kingdom right now, but yay for all the new stuff we're getting.
Soon enough. And yes. Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. I was apparently a robot right before this, and now I'm not, so I'm feeling better. Let's jump right in, because there's a lot to get through. So the keynote saved, it's sort of like it put all the boring, I'm quoting boring, because it's not boring to a lot of people, but all the non-consumer stuff is front-loaded. Then there was the Android section with Material U, and then there was Wear OS at the end, or Wear, if you want to be accurate about it. So we are going to change up the order. We're going to talk about the enterprise-y non-consumer stuff last, and we're going to front-load Android 12, because I think that's why everybody's listening. So Android 12, we've had 3 developer previews. Now we have our first beta. Ara, I want to start with you, because the biggest change is visual to at least the beta itself, and we'll talk about why. So walk us through Material U, or as a lot of the Googlers in these pre-recorded sessions called it, Material Next. It seems like the Material U branding was slapped on last week, last minute. But what is Material U? What is its relationship with Android? And how are we supposed to think about Android 12 in relation to the big, like, what's the big picture right now in terms of Android 12?
So Material U isn't just going to be for Android. Apparently, it's going to come to Chromebooks in some shape or form in the next year or so as well, I think. But Material U is the next iteration, the next generation of material design, which debuted at Google I.O. in 2014, which coincidentally was the year that Android Wear launched. And this year we got updates to both platforms. Yay! Material U, it's going to make everything more dynamic. It's going to make everything more responsive. It's going to help make Android look more cohesive and also make it look more personal. Because we're going to have dynamic colors. Pulling colors out of the wallpaper is going to start with the pixels, but all Android 12 phones should be able to set dynamic colors, a dynamic palette. And then those colors will be reflected across your home screen, reflected across system elements, and reflected across apps, which is great because that means that Android 12, you can make it look unique without having to get into this bulky, not great to use custom theming system the way that Samsung has Samsung Themes in Theme Park, and ColorOS for Oppo has Universal Themes, just all these different systems that Android manufacturers have had to build over the last 5 years. They're kind of clunky. They're not great. Android 12 and Material U are going to help make this easier and help build it into the system more functionally and more simple and more in a more easy to implement way, which is great. So this is going to lead to the redesign of a bunch. Like I see most, if not all, of the Google apps being redesigned in the next year or two to match Material U. Same goes for a lot of the system widgets that haven't really changed in the last 5 or 10 years. So it's a nice visual refresh. It helps update things. It helps make it feel a little bit more intuitive. It also makes everything a little bit more fluid and fun, which is great because I'm sorry to say Android had kind of gotten boring the last couple of years from a visual perspective.
And something interesting that I noticed in the keynote yesterday is that this isn't just Android, right? This is going to be rolled out across the whole of Google in the same way that we had that with Material Design 5 years ago. We have Matthias Duarte talking about This isn't just going to be, okay, you take your Android wallpaper and it themes the rest of your stuff on your phone. It's going to be more like, this is the color scheme that follows you through all the properties that you, all the Google properties that you interact with, whether it's on a phone, on a tablet, on the web, or wherever.
I wonder, Jerry, if you can walk us through the relationship, and I keep saying the word relationship because I think it's an important word here when we're talking about something Google wants to be more personal. But Android is as much about the developers, and Google I/O specifically is as much about the developers as it is about announcing consumer products. So Alex mentioned eventually Material U will live on other platforms. Those color decisions that you put on your Android phone may carry over to your Chrome browser, and your whole Google world will just be defined by a few personal settings or whatever color palette you want. If you want your line breaks or your lines to be thicker, or your font weighting to be a particular style, whatever, it'll carry through. And I think that's interesting because Google services just embed themselves in our lives in ways that we don't even realize. Material design took a long time to get to everywhere, and then it took even longer for developers to adopt it and bring those best practices into their apps. So from your perspective, is Material U a developer language or a developer set of developer best practices, or is this something that consumers like us should really care about as a system of design?
I think, and this is, I think, you know, we're going to have to wait until we see it come out a little bit more. It's both. For the end user, it's just how things are going to look, and hopefully you like them. But developers are the ones that are going to need to do the work. If you use the Chrome browser, and it doesn't matter if it's on Mac or on Windows, any non-Google operating system, you know, you can theme the Chrome browser. You can change the color of some elements and stuff. Imagine if that carried through to all of Google's properties. Let's say if you set your browser so it's black with red highlights and you open Gmail, you can theme Gmail to be, you know, kind of the same now, but in theory, it's just going to follow along. There's going to be a component when they build the application, and yes, Gmail on the web is an application that can follow, you know, these practices, and then the rendering engine knows how to take that, you know, metadata and display it in a certain way. And it's, I mean, it's a pretty big convergence of a non-phone app to act more like a phone app, I guess is a way to say it. It's something that I'm sure is entirely possible now, but it took, you know, Google to plan out how to make this so it's a code once, works everywhere kind of thing. It's also my understanding that this is just going to be part of, you know, a web developer's kit too. They can, you know, we could make Android Central follow your Chrome browser theme if we wanted to. And that's, you know, makes for some interesting changes to how the things we use every day are going to look and act. Not so much the color. I know a lot of people are really interested in the colors, but things like the font sizing and the spacing and the size of the scroll bars, that adds a lot of functionality too. Maybe, you know, you have some visual impairment, you need things to be further apart and bigger fonts and heavier weighting. It would be great if that just automatically happened, no matter if you were using your phone or a Chromebook, or ideally even the Chrome browser on another machine.
Ara, we've talked a lot about on this show our desire for Google to be more opinionated about its Android design, right? Material design, yes, took over from Holo. It was a big change, but as you said, it's 7 years old. It's morphed a little bit. It's had two major updates since its launch, but Android as a as an operating system, at least Google's decisions around it haven't changed very much since 2014. So when you look at Android 12 and you see the potential for how people are going to be able to customize their devices, but also maintain a cohesion in Material Next, in the sense that the lock screen is going to have this very dominant digital clock, the drop down menu and your notification shade is going to have these massive quick settings buttons. The settings menu itself is just going to be larger. It's going to be more one hand friendly. How do you think Google thought about this in setting up Material U for the next 5 to 7 years, right? If you're thinking in half decade timelines for major design language updates, what did Google think about when rolling this out first to Android phones, but eventually to all of its properties?
Well, I think a major thing here was they wanted to make sure that whatever they did was still accessible. And I think the fonts being larger on things like the lock screen and in the settings is also because they're also designing for their audience, a lot of Android users and a lot of people in general. Like, the boomer generation is getting older and most of them are having to use larger fonts on their phone. I mean, having a larger font by default for many things is going to make it easier for people to read this. It also makes it easier to just kind of glance at your settings if you're trying to do something else and you're like, okay, why aren't my Bluetooth headphones pairing? So I think it's a matter of trying to maintain functionality and maintain accessibility while still updating things and making it more intuitive.
And you talked to a bunch of designers and developers about this before yesterday. What did they have to say about these upcoming changes and how Material U would potentially impact their Play Store products, right? You're talking about widget creators and people who design launchers and apps for your home screen.
Yeah, most of them were very, very happy with this because most of them are kind of like me. They were like, okay, Android had gotten kind of boring. We needed a refresh. For the love of God, we just needed a shot in the arm for widgets because widgets just have not gotten the love that they deserve. And we got some of that yesterday. Unfortunately, since most of the things that were announced for Material U yesterday aren't in beta 1, we can't really play with most of it yet. Unless you're a developer and you have Android Studio and you can start playing with the new palettes for widgets. But at the same time, it's a lot of this is a great start, but execution is everything.
And we just have to say they are actually, like Apple did with iOS 14, they're redesigning how developers can build widgets, right? This is not just about how widgets look, but also they're giving widgets themselves a development shot in the arm for the first time in a long time.
Yes. And one thing that's going to be nice, and I feel like I should mention this now, no, not all of your widgets are going to be required to be rounded, but they are requiring that if your launcher wants to round all of the widgets, you need to have a setting in there to where, like, on a launcher scale, you can be like, okay, I want square widgets, or maybe I want rounded widgets, or maybe I want the little squircle widgets. But they're trying to make it so widgets are more uniform, so that way it can look more uniform in your system without being just, here's the one design, here's the only way you can make widgets, which is good, because we still have a little bit of flexibility.
And talk about, we mentioned this before, but also talk about the fact that Google, one of the showpieces of Android 12's eventual release is that it'll pull colors from your wallpaper. What are the idiosyncrasies of that? Like, how is it actually going to work?
Okay, there are two things for color, and I keep conflating them, and I need to not do that. So dynamic color palettes are going to be available on all Pixel 12 or on all Android 12 phones, not just Pixels. What is going to be Pixel specific is the pulling colors directly from the background. So for Pixels, you're going to be able to do it automatically. For other devices, other manufacturers, if dynamic colors are built in, it's you set the palette manually and then it reflects everywhere. But for pulling the colors in, Google has written an algorithm in order to make sure that it analyzes the color of your wallpaper. It picks out 5 colors based on what colors are dominant in your wallpaper. And it also takes into account, it needs to make sure that every color that is picked is compliant with A11Y accessibility requirements, because that if your font colors are too light or too dark, that can make contrast a real issue, especially when translating between a light-themed app and a dark-themed app. So the algorithm has had to be trained in order to make sure, okay, I can look at your wallpaper, I can tell what colors are dominant, and I can give you 5 colors and make sure none of them will be unreadable. Because you can't have it be that I set a wallpaper and then I can't see any of my screens because the font and the background are too similar.
And on top of that, you also need for those colors that it does select to be essentially material colors. So it needs to be within a certain sort of...
It has to be within a certain range.
Within a certain range, and also colors that complement each other. So if you're looking at this and thinking, okay, why do we not have this in the current Android 12 beta? It's actually not as simple as you would think with just selecting certain colors in your wallpaper. There's actually a lot of other stuff that you need to do once you've selected... the primary color, the complementary colors. You need to make sure it works well in dark mode, in light mode, that it's accessible, all this other stuff. So it's not just a case of, okay, you have a blue wallpaper, so you have blue icons. It's actually a lot more complicated than that. And that's kind of the reason why we kind of don't have this yet, and why it's going to take a little bit of time to get this up and running on Pixel phones, and why it's also just on Pixels this release cycle, not across the entirety of Android.
Well, we don't know if it's going to come to other manufacturers before Android 13. We just know that it's starting with Pixels.
So they said within the following year, I think was the way it was worded. So basically Pixels first, and then within the year after that, you know, other phones will get it. But basically, it's not part of CTS. It's not something that you need to do if you're releasing an Android 12 phone or if you're updating the existing phone to Android 12.
It's also worth remembering Microsoft started this in 1999. I know that's before some of y'all out there were even born, but dynamic theming, just dynamic based on you pick an image, is not anything new, and it took Microsoft 20 years to make it into something that people didn't just absolutely hate. So don't expect everything to just be perfect right off the bat. There's a lot of work Google has to do to fine-tune this once they actually release it.
So what you're saying is expect this to be perfected in, like, Android 32?
Yeah, so maybe. You know, maybe Google is better at this than Microsoft was. Who knows? But I know, Alex, you're old enough to have used Windows Millennial Edition, Millennium Edition,
whatever. Millennium Edition. Windows NE.
Remember how garbage it used to look when you changed your wallpaper? And
I'll have you know, Jerry, I jumped from 98 straight to XP. Thank you very much.
So
then you're a weirdo. Potential, NE was fine.
There's the potential for that to happen here, too, where you put your favorite photo as your phone background and, like, holy crap, everything looks so bad now.
I just don't. I want to interrupt because I don't want anybody to have missed that. Aura supports Windows Millennial Edition.
Yeah, hey, I think that was the first version that I got on my first, like, it's mine desktop.
Aura just praised Windows ME. Just want to put that out there. It's a thing. It's on the record. It's canon now.
I'm a freak. This is known.
This is wild to me. Thank you for sharing that very important piece of blackmail. all right, I want to also talk a little bit about something that is, you can feel it in beta 1. It's not all there yet, but Google did talk about how, due to some improvements to garbage collection and a bunch of the background processes, it was able to reduce the core system CPU usage by 22%. Along with a 15% reduction in the use of the more powerful CPU cores in a lot of the flagship phones that we have today. I mean, if you know, most Qualcomm devices, most ARM-based devices are divided into performance cores and efficiency cores. Most phones today, even cheaper ones, have sort of a 2x4, 2x6, 2x2 ratio, or 4x4 sometimes in more powerful devices. And what they're saying is that because of these optimizations, those more powerful cores won't be used as much, and the efficiency cores will take over more often. As a result, this will be result in smoother and quote silkier animations, which is why the early versions of the settings overhaul were called Silky Home in the developer previews. So Jerry, I just want to talk about that because I've noticed this a lot, along with the new animations, the bounce effects, the sparkles and stuff like that in Android 12 Beta 1. You can just feel that, at least on the Pixel 5 at least, it's a bit smoother. It feels more like a flagship phone. And I wanted to see how you think Google achieved that.
Google's goal is to make the user interface not need the big cores at all. I mean, that's every company's goal when they make software, is to do it as efficiently, both power-wise and processing time, as possible. And I am sure that a large portion of the work went into optimize and think ahead. And software can't really think, but the software kind of knows in advance what's going to happen, and it can pre-render, pre-draw, pre-build this stuff so it doesn't need a ton of processing power. I don't notice much difference on the Pixel 4, but that, you know, I could understand you see a bigger difference on the Pixel 5 because the processor arrangement is much different. And any optimization they did would show itself, you know, more on something like the Pixel 5 or the Pixel 4a than it would just an old, you know, Snapdragon 4.4 arrangement. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing because, you know, Samsung is still going to make, you know, cheaper phones and they're still going to sell. And, you know, nobody wants their phone to be crappy.
All right, let's talk about the changes to privacy. So some of these were teased in the keynote and we got briefed on this before the keynote. None of them are available yet in beta one. But Jerry, let's just go over them because they're important. From a settings and sort of user-facing perspective, there is now going to be a privacy dashboard built into the settings menu where you'll be able to go through a timeline of what apps use various permissions, which is great. It's also going to look a lot like the digital well-being dashboard, which shows you your breakdown of how off, you know, how much you're on Twitter, for example. Yeah. But in this case, it's how many apps used your location, how many apps used your camera, how many apps used your microphone.
Which is awesome.
Which is and BlackBerry Key One.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. This is what BlackBerry's solution should have done. Rather than just tell you there's a problem, it should give you these kind of details. So Google finally did what BlackBerry didn't. And this is very useful information. I really can't wait to see this and to play with it and see if I can break it or trick it, because this is the kind of information we need. They also threw out another little tidbit that it was either 67 or 69% of phone buyers care about the security of the operating system. So nice. If you've got that many people that care about security, and privacy goes hand in hand with security, it's great to give them tools so they can look at it and see just how they're being affected. So this is awesome. Great. Yes, it's not going to be perfect. Yes, there are people who still aren't going to trust Google, rightfully so in many cases, but this is a step that Google has to make. If we ever want Google to get better when it comes to digital privacy, this is a great point to start.
Couple other quick things. There will be toggles at a system level in the quick settings menu to disable the camera and the microphone. It's basically just a hard cut to those to any apps accessing those APIs. So
like the Google Home Hub. Remember it?
Right. It's the equivalent of a switch that disables them at the hardware level. That means if you open the camera app, the app will still open, but it'll just get a black feed from all of the cameras. I think Android Police reached out to Google and asked whether there will be a distinction between front-facing camera and rear-facing. Like, will you be able to granularly set that? And I don't know if they've heard back yet. I would suspect not, just because so many different phones will have configurations that may not apply you know, evenly across the board. So it'll just be, you know, safer just to make it a blanket. No, you cannot use the camera. Same with the microphones. And then there's this new locations API. So if your app targets Android S, it will require developers to ask users whether they want to provide precise or coarse location data. And this is this coarse location data API is already available to developers, but most of them don't use it because precise location is more advantageous to them.
Worth
for
more
example,
money.
if it's a mapping app, they don't want to provide right. users information about a 1 square kilometer radius. They want to use GPS data to give you accurate reading. Google told us that this setting is for apps like weather apps that do ask for your location because obviously they need to know where you are, but they don't need to know where you are down to the meter or to the foot for
exactly.
you Americans out there.
Launcher developers were also really happy with this for all the ones that integrate the weather widget on the home screen because they were like, oh yeah, people get antsy when we ask for location, but we just want it for the weather. So approximate is going to be easy for us.
And right now, like you said, this is already available. A developer can give you that type of control if they want to. And
they can't. Not in a prompt, though. You have to give them permission and then go into the settings and ask them to change it from precise to coarse.
But yeah, the difference here is this: when you first fire up an app and it asks, you know, this app wants to use your location. Do you want to grant it? You know, the use of your location, or just this time, or just when the app is open. Now there's a two buttons at the top. Essentially, one is coarse and one is fine. That means I can say only while the app is open and only coarse location permission, because nobody needs to see what aisle I'm in at Walmart. And that just... It's not like there are so many developers out there trying to steal your location data, but there are a lot of ad platforms that really love to sell your location data. We've seen carriers even make a lot of money selling location data. This, unfortunately, can't fix that, but this means you don't have to allow your favorite solitaire game to know, you know, when you've left your front yard and went into the backyard, because they don't need to know that. If an ad network wants to know your approximate location, that's bad enough, but at least now you can filter that out. This is the best thing I've seen in Android in years. We all need to get behind this and, you know, I don't know how Google is going to handle it for older apps that never bother to update. I hope they get kicked out of the store. Put that hand down.
It's more about peace of mind, I think, than anything else.
Yep.
Right. You know, we've all been there and seen an app that wants access to your location, and you're probably not particularly you know, comfortable giving it your exact location down to the millimeter, but probably you would be okay telling it which town you're in, which city you're in. This is just a way of sort of codifying that in Android so that people understand it.
A lot of times location is very useful, even to an advertiser. I always go back to a store app, let's say the Target app or the Walmart app, or, you know, whatever other in-person brick and mortar store you might still visit, your grocery store. That it's very advantageous to you if that app knows when it looks like you're about to go in an Albertsons to buy some groceries. Because they can show you coupons, they can show you specials, they can show you these kind of things that benefit you. There should be two sides to every relationship, and of course, the store itself, who made the app, and the developers who made the app for that store, they benefit because they have, you know, metrics about how often people are visiting, how long they're there. That kind of stuff is very valuable, but we also benefit from that. But there is nothing we benefit from giving our exact precise location away. So this is great.
I want to point out an article that our newest reporter, Shruti Shikhar, did at about this very feature. So she talked to a bunch of privacy experts about whether this is privacy theater for all intents and purposes, right? Google is in the ad business, giving developers, maintaining this relationship with ad networks is still kind of scummy if those vendors are still allowed to sell, you know, bundle up and sell that data, even if it's anonymized. There really hasn't been the same push to for Google to provide this the privacy disclosure that Apple has started forcing developers to do. Google did hint at an upcoming announcement to Dieter Bohn and his preview of Android 12 yesterday at The Verge. If you want to read that, he has a bit more detail on it. But suffice it to say, this is good, but it still allows developers to get muddled data and bundle that more muddled data up and still sort of apply a user profile to you, even if the precise location is not available to them. Because it doesn't use GPS, but it still uses Wi-Fi and cellular towers to give developers a 1 square kilometer radius of your location. 1 square kilometer, if you track that over time, can give them a pretty clear idea of where you're going. And even if it doesn't give them your exact address, it still lets them target you for ads and sell that data or work with those resellers to sell that data. So this is not a huge solution. The other part I have to mention is that, Jerry, you said that you would like all apps to have to include this, which would mean all apps need to target Android 12. Last November, Google said that by August of this year, all new apps needed to target API level 30, which is Android 11. And by November, all apps that get updated, November of 2021, all apps that get updated in the Play Store will need to target Android 11. So no developer in 2021 will be required to target Android 12. But Google is obviously encouraging these developers by giving them access not just to this API, but to all the new APIs that are included in Android 12. So that's a lot of words to say. This will not really affect most people in the short term, but in a couple of years, when most apps do target Android 12, it will make a big difference.
It can affect you if you want to do it like I do it. If a developer doesn't want to update his app, I don't need that developer. He can go pound sand. I'll uninstall it and try another one.
Or on the other side of things, there's still time for a developer to release a terrible location slurping app and just never update it until like 2025.
Well, I hate to see Google have a heavy hand because I think they have too much control over Android as it is. But this is one time where if Google came out and said, okay, look, July 2022, every application in Google Play that can't follow this simple rule gets kicked out. I would love to see it happen. Get rid of it, because I know what to look for. A lot of you people listening know what to look for, but a whole lot of other people don't know what to look for. And they, you know, they hear that, oh, Android is now better about not tracking your exact movements. So it's safe to download this app and click OK when it asks for my permission, because it might not be safe.
And Google has Google Play in particular has become a lot more heavy-handed with stuff like this over the past 2-3 years, right?
Well, also, let's remember that Google Play came out with that timeline for when, okay, we're going to update the way that you present the permissions that you use in Google Play in the listing, but we're not. But users aren't going to be able to even see that data until next year. And hopefully by then, at least some apps will have updated to the Android 12 APIs. Because if you can say, okay, you have the option for not opting for as much as precise a location control, you can opt out of location altogether, or you can opt out of using X permission or Y permission or Z permission. That will make the app more attractive, ideally.
I'll tell everybody listening how you can take a little bit of control over this. When you get a phone that has Android 12 on it, when you spend your hard-earned money and you buy that phone yourself, and you go to install an app, the first time you use it, if it doesn't give you the option to select a course location, and that's what it's called, course location, uninstall it. Forget it. Uninstall it. Try a different one.
Keep trying it. I think the phrasing is approximate in the pop-up.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. The course approximate location API.
Okay. Yeah. If you do that, you can benefit from this big change to Android. If you would rather not do that and you're okay with giving your location data away, hey, that's up to you. But if you want to take advantage of this, you can. It is in your hands now. Before, it wasn't.
All right, so let's finish up on Android 12. The first beta is available now for Pixel devices from Pixel 3 and above, RIP Pixel 2. It's also available for 15 other phones from Xiaomi to, well, not OnePlus because they were bricking devices and the beta got pulled. But for Xiaomi, Vivo, Oppo, Sharp, if you're in Japan, Tecno, if I think that's an Indian or African brand, I'm not super familiar. There's a bunch of devices that are launching with. There's the TCL 20 Pro, the Nokia X20. It's a weird list this year. But if you have any of those phones, sure, go ahead, go nuts. We will have lots more coverage of Android 12. There's going to be a beta every month through August, and then there's going to be the final release probably late August, early September. So we will come back to this as new features get added.
Can we back off on the go nuts a little bit? I mean, read it first. Like, what is it? Oppo tells
people
you.
People listening to this know they're not.
I know,
you can't just accidentally install Android 12. If you're listening to this and you want to install it, go ahead. But, you know, there be dragons, as Phil used to say. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back and talk about Wear OS or Wear or whatever. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. AI can do some incredible things, but for most jobs at your company, you need a good old-fashioned carbon-based life form, preferably a brilliant one, preferably as soon as possible. If you're looking for great minds that move the world, you can hire them with Indeed. Indeed is the job site that makes hiring as easy as 1, 2, 3. Post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. Get your quality shortlist of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description faster. Only pay for the candidates that meet must-have qualifications and schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. Indeed makes connecting with and hiring the right talent fast and easy. With tools like Indeed Instant Match, giving you quality candidates whose resume on Indeed fits your job description immediately. And Indeed skills tests that on average reduces hiring time by 27%. You can choose from more than 130 skills tests, then add your must-have requirements so you only pay for applications that meet them. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined. So if you're hiring, you need Indeed. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. Get a $75 credit, Indeed.com/ACP. Indeed.com/ACP. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply. Okay, so as big as Android 12 was at the keynote, I think Wear OS was a bigger deal for a lot of people, even though the install base is much, much, much smaller. Ara, give us the TLDR on what is happening with Wear and why Samsung has so much to do with it.
Okay, so Samsung makes great watch hardware, and they have a relatively consistent, like, Samsung has the best watch experience on Android, except for one thing: they can never get app support. And Google has all of these watches that they have great app support. They have newer features. They have wider compatibility, but the hardware just kind of doesn't match up, which means that the software experience doesn't quite match up either, because everything ends up being older and slower. So we're taking Samsung's chocolate and Google's peanut butter and bringing them together and hopefully getting some delicious Reese's peanut butter cup-like watches that are going to be able to have it all and finally compete with Apple watches the way that we've needed them to for 5 years.
Hungry, Ara?
No, not at all. What would make you think that? But yes, I really do want to go run into the other room for a Reese's in a bit. I'm super excited about this because I wear a Samsung watch right now. I'm wearing the original Galaxy Watch Active. And whenever the Galaxy Watch Active 4 comes out, presumably in August, that is an insta-buy for me, because it's like, oh, cool, I can have the nice, concise, small watch with a decent battery life, but I'm finally going to be able to get Google services on it. I'm finally going to be able to use Google Pay and Google Keep on this thing instead of being stuck with Samsung Pay and not having a decent note-taking app at all. So, there's happy.
Some serious ripping off the Band-Aid here, too, though, because
yeah,
if you have a watch that you like right now, you're not seeing this update.
Yeah. I've got a TicWatch Pro 3. I've got a Fossil Gen 5e. I'm not optimistic that any of those will see the update, except maybe the TicWatch Pro 3, because that has the Wear 4100.
The watches that get this update are going to be the exception and not the rule, I think.
Right.
That's made and very clear.
It has to be that way. There's just no other way to take a platform, slam on the brakes, change directions, and go forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is a major update from a software perspective, and it's also going to impact the hardware that it runs on. So this is a big deal, and I'm very happy that we're finally getting it. It also means that if you bought a watch in the last year or so, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, but your watch is probably going to be kind of stagnant.
So let's actually just talk about the implications, not for existing devices, which we don't know, except for Galaxy Watch products, which we do know. Those will not be updated. We know that Samsung will commit to 3 years of security and software updates, which means that the original Galaxy Watch and Galaxy Watch Active are not long for this world. They have like 8 months and 1 year and 8 months remaining.
The Galaxy Watch has 3 months remaining. The Galaxy Watch Active has 10 months remaining. The Galaxy Watch Active 2 has 16 months. And the Galaxy Watch 3 has 27 months.
Okay, there you go. Math. Sorry. So that we know. But let's talk about what a Pixel Watch maybe would look like. So Google has shown off some but not all of the aesthetic changes, right? We know that developers will be able to build their own tiles, that there will be new gestures, that there will be new health APIs that integrate, that are available to all developers, but Fitbit and Samsung will take advantage of them. We know that Google will be overhauling its first-party apps from the ground up, including offline playback for YouTube Music. Spotify also committed to offline playback today, which is great. There's going to be turn-by-turn navigation for Google Maps. There's going to be expansion of Google Pay. There's going to be just a new breed of apps on Wear OS. We'll talk about why I keep hesitating in a second. And overall, things are just going to look a little bit more like, watch OS on the Apple Watch or Tizen. But from a fundamental like developer perspective, Jerry, what do we know so far about how Google is approaching Wear OS going forward? They're opening it up to OEMs because Google wants a company like Samsung to build a Wear watch that is closer in aesthetic to a Galaxy phone, and that Samsung will control the updates. But what else do we know?
Not a lot. Google said the word platform a lot, and they alluded to the platform being a amalgamation of software and hardware. That tells me right off the bat, I'm waiting for Qualcomm's response to this. I can't believe that Qualcomm's sensors and stuff won't just work. But, you know, we need to hear Qualcomm tell us that. On the hardware side, are the new watches going to, you know, look the same? And I don't mean look. I mean, under the hood, are they going to work the same way that they do now? Probably, mostly. Aesthetically, you covered it. It's going to look a lot like, you know, what we see now from the competition. For developers, it gives developers a new toolbox. I think a big part of the reason why Wear OS kind of stagnated, and that's a friendly way to say that, is because there was only so much you could do that without giving a bad experience to the user. We've all tried to do something on our watch, and it's just so terribly slow and horrible and we just didn't like it. That makes a developer look bad. And not only that, it makes the manufacturer of the device look bad. So if Samsung can take a Google Wear, Wear OS, whatever we're calling it, I'll defer to you on that, and make it resemble it both in the way it looks and the way it feels to use it, the Galaxy S phone, that's a win for Samsung. That's going to keep people wanting to buy Samsung products. It's going to make users probably more happy. You know, you knew what you were signing up for when you bought it, and it's not going to give you any bad surprises. But it's a double-edged sword. Does that mean that, you remember how bad Android used to be, what, 6-7 years ago, when every manufacturer did something completely different, and then carriers got in, and it just, no two phones were the same, and more than half of them were just bad? I don't see that happening. I don't think Google's going to give up that level of control, but we just don't know yet until we see some more announcements and see some of these products coming, you know, what they're going to be like.
We do know, so we know that at least we have a good suspicion that there will be a Pixel Watch alongside the Pixel 6. Last week's John Prosser leak included renders that placed the previously, you know, quote, announced or leaked Pixel Watch next to the Pixel 6. It's, yep. At this point, it's a home run. We also know that Fitbit got up on stage and committed to not only supporting Wear OS, but putting Wear OS on its upcoming smartwatches.
I wasn't including Google here. And for all intents and purposes, Fitbit is Google.
Yeah, and I think we probably, when we're talking about Pixel Watch and we're talking about a Fitbit smartwatch, I think those could very well turn out to be the same thing.
I wasn't going to go that far, but I agree completely.
From what I know about the Pixel Watch, there's a lot of Fitbit in it, and I think that probably will be the direction this ends up going.
Which
is not a bad idea, right? But then the question is, does Fitbit just be, this is a separate conversation, but then does Fitbit
become a services company?
Does Fitbit become a services company and occasionally update its trackers at $99, you know, for people who still want them? Again, not super important right now. We can have that discussion later. But from what I've seen, having deep health integration in Wear OS is what's going to be the difference between me picking up a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or a Wear OS watch. Like, I have I can pick up any platform when I work out to track what I'm doing. I almost always pick up my Fitbit Sense because it has automatic workout tracking, because it's relatively accurate and it's super comfortable, and I can sync it to an iPhone or an Android phone. I've never picked up a Wear OS watch to track my fitness.
And it's also a question of branding, right? If Google is to release a Pixel Watch, you know, Google owns Fitbit. Are you going to release, okay, here's the Pixel Watch, which is a watch based on a phone series you probably don't care about? Or is it going to be, okay, here's a fancy new Fitbit? Probably you're going to go for the last of that.
Potentially, for sure.
Well, I'm just more interested in what is Samsung going to do? Samsung's not going to abandon Samsung Health, but let's say it does. There's a lot of data in there. There's still a lot of unanswered questions here, specifically about the Samsung and Google partnership. I expect that they're smarter than I am, and they've already thought of all this. And, you know, long before any product comes along, all these questions will be answered. But right now, I'm just curious what the plans are.
I think the service side of things is probably quite separate from the OS and hardware side of things.
Right.
I can't see Samsung releasing a Wear OS watch that doesn't, you know, integrate with Google Fit.
I'm sure it will.
But will it integrate with Samsung Health independently, or
there won't be a Samsung? So from Samsung said explicitly, there will not be Samsung Health on its upcoming smartwatches,
okay,
in the way that we think about them today, right? There is explicitly, you can go to a Samsung Health app on your Galaxy Watch. That won't exist. What will likely exist is there will be a health section in your Samsung Wear OS watch that uses the same underlying health APIs that Google and Samsung are co-building. Mm. And Samsung will brand it. And then on a separate watch, Google will brand it. And then, or whatever, Mobvoi will brand it. So that they don't have to build out their own apps. They can just have
sure.
a turnkey, like white label version of the Google Fit app.
Which is the plus side to allowing manufacturers to brand Wear OS a little more than in the past. You know, that can't be overlooked. You know, that Samsung Health isn't going to disappear on your Galaxy S phone. I don't ever see that happening. So
I'm willing to bet once the Tizen powered wearables are kaput, I could see them sunsetting Galaxy Health and pushing you towards like Fit and pushing you towards either Fitbit or Strava or something. Because I mean, it's without the wearables to connect into, I'm not sure how they make money from Galaxy Health. If that makes sense,
I don't know. I just that's a good way to piss a lot of people off.
Samsung has proven that it's very willing to turn off a service and use Google's version when it will mean that they don't lose money on a service that competes directly with Google's.
Hey, maybe they'll put Microsoft Health on.
I would not. You know what, Ara? I would not be surprised. The fact that Samsung committed not to bring Samsung Health over to Wear OS and is committing to using those open APIs tells me, at least, that Samsung is caring less about that service, as you said, because Samsung is working closer with Google. And if it can't monetize it, if there's no Samsung Health Plus business model down the road, whereas Google can obviously monetize Fitbit Premium, then yeah, I mean, maybe just Samsung goes in and has a quote health app on its phones that's just part of the OS that they really don't have to maintain or do anything with.
What it tells me is that so much money has changed hands yep. to make this happen that the amount of money that Samsung was making out of its health ecosystem is trivial by comparison. Obviously, an immense amount of cash has changed hands between Samsung and Google to make this next generation wearable platform happen. And you know, probably as Ara says, a side effect of that is going to be the Samsung Health ecosystem probably dies because the amount of money they were making is so trivial compared to the fat stack of cash they're getting from Google.
If that's the case, and I can totally see a Samsung CEO with a new yacht named Samsung Health from all the money they were given. But that, because Samsung's not going to give up on something it has such an investment in. It not without a way to recoup some of the cost it's sunk into it. If that's how they get the cost back, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think Google as well is being deliberately vague here because we need to wait until hardware announcements, plus the fact that this is a co-announcement with Samsung, which had very limited time on stage yesterday, plus Samsung is co-developing it and Google's I.O. conference, Samsung probably ceded a lot of control over that messaging. So it was very complicated. The other part of it is that Google just stopped referring to Wear OS as Wear OS in its public branding, and it's now calling it just Wear or the Wear platform, which is weird.
Samsung as well, right? Not referring to it as anything, referring to it as
the new OS.
The new OS,
the unified development platform and the new OS. So it's really like there's going to be a lot of stay tuned for the next thing.
August cannot come fast enough. I can't wait. I can't wait to see these watches.
Some of the inside baseball I know that had Alex and I really puzzled is the early embargoed materials they sent to us referred to this as a new operating system. And we're like, whoa, wait a minute. What? That was weird.
So we were trying to figure out, okay, so it's either one or the other, right? It's not both.
Right.
Like, which one dies, you know, which one continues forward? And we have to be very clear that of the two platforms, one has been a lot more successful than the other. Okay, neither has taken on the Apple Watch in any meaningful way, but Samsung's wearables have been a hell of a lot more successful than Google's wearables. So at a software level, which one is it going forward? And we still don't really have an answer to that.
I wonder if are wearables that run Android or Google software, whatever it's called, at a price point that more people can, you know, afford, is that going to change just how many people actually use wearables? Apple leads the category by a country mile, but they're still, I mean, that the number of watches they sell pales in, you know, when you compare it to any of their other products. Is that going to change this? Is this enough to make people care about wearables? And then, you know, we already saw Apple release a slightly cheaper version of the watch this last time. Is that something that they're going to, you know, do as an answer? Are you going to be able to get a really good Apple Watch at a really good price? Because hopefully you can get a really good Android watch at a really good price, which would be really, I think, great for the entire, both ecosystems.
If the Galaxy Watch Active 4 is under $200, that's a no-brainer insta-buy for me.
Come on.
Because that'll fit reasonably on my wrist, and if it'll have the app support. And I really hope the app support for whatever the new Google Wear is, I really hope that app experience is a lot better, especially for more complicated apps. I kept trying to get my dad to use Golf Pad on the watch that I lent him, and it just wasn't really working that well. And Golf Pad was one of the demonstration tiles that they had during the keynote, and I was like, oh, that's nice to see them there, because that app sucks right now.
I also think that we have to consider just how many of these accessories in Samsung's ecosystem are bundled with phone sales.
Yeah.
Right? I would venture to say a fairly large percentage of Galaxy Watch or Galaxy Wearable users or Galaxy Buds owners got those products as bundles with a pre-order or a carrier deal in the early days of a phone's release, and would not have necessarily gone out of their way to spend $200 to $300 on that product. So it's also worth thinking, this OS decision likely won't matter to people who are just getting these for free and may just use it because it works nicely with their phone or whatever.
And that's probably not going to change.
Totally. It shouldn't change, because that marketing side of it is completely separate. I mean, one could imagine Samsung will just continue calling them the Galaxy Watch series or whatever, Galaxy Watch Active, Galaxy Watch, and that'll be that. And just like we talked about last week when Samsung moved from Android to Tizen, this is just the reverse of that in 2021. So we will talk lots more about it. We're going to take a quick second break and come back and just go through all of the rest of the announcements at Google I/O, because there were quite a few. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by HelloFresh. HelloFresh gives you pre-measured ingredients and mouthwatering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. And that's why it is America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh cuts out the stressful meal planning and grocery store trips and gets dinner on the table in about 30 minutes or less. And HelloFresh offers more than 25 recipes to choose from every week, from vegetarian meals to craft burgers and extra special gourmet options. There is something for everyone to enjoy, with all recipes designed and tested by professional chefs and nutritional experts to ensure deliciousness and simplicity. I really dislike grocery shopping, but once I get all of my ingredients in front of me, I really enjoy the act of cooking. And that is why when I've used HelloFresh, I've always had a ton of fun. The ingredients are really good. There's no like rotten spinach leaves that you have to throw out. Everything feels really, really good quality and right from the depot. And the recipes are easy and well laid out. They're just fun to make. I find cooking really cathartic, and HelloFresh has always made that process just super fun and easy. And I've never had a complaint, and I have some pretty tough critics, including my two-year-old daughter, who actually eats the food that I make. So I'm really grateful for that. So if you're interested in trying HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/12ACP and use the code 12ACP for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That's 12ACP for 12 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. All right. So there are like 10 lines here in the show notes of different announcements. I don't want to get through all of them. Let's just talk about the most important ones. The ones that I think matter to consumers are Android in the car, Android TV, Google Photos, Google Maps, Google Assistant, maybe AR Core. Let's start with Android in the car. This was a pretty fast announcement, but it gave us a hint about a feature coming to the Pixel 6. Ultra wideband support is coming to Android 12. They will build in digital car key support for select devices and cars later this year. Alex, high level, what does this actually mean, right? Unless you own a $100,000 BMW, you're not really going to benefit from this. But what does the announcement of UWB support in Android 12 actually mean?
So there's a lot that you can actually do with that, right? And we've seen this from other manufacturers, like I think probably the biggest example of it is LG using it for the secondary displays they have in the dual display phones. There's a lot you can do with this technology, and having that built into the OS, obviously there are capabilities you can have there in terms of connecting it to a display inside a car. But there are also a bunch of other things that you could potentially do, with plugging into alternate devices, with dual screens and stuff like that. And we've had this for a little while. It's been rumored to be coming to Android at the OS level, and now it seems like that's happening. And it's kind of a big deal. There's a lot you can do with exchanging information at that speed over a short distance. And we'll have to wait and see how that pans out over the next few months and years. But obviously, one of the main ways you could do that right now is, display data, right? Having fast exchange of data between your main display on your phone and something else. And you can do that in your car. You can do that in an attached accessory. You can kind of take it from there as to where that technology goes.
All right. So Google also mentioned that Android Auto is now available in 100 million cars, which is kind of wild. Google is also going to be expanding wireless Android Auto availability to a bunch of other cars.
Thank goodness.
Which is great. I actually, we were in a minor accident a few months ago. The car that I got from the rental place had wireless Android Auto. It was super janky, but it was awesome because you put your phone into the wireless charger in the little dash next to you, and it connects to Android Auto automatically. It just worked. It had a really nice touchscreen. So I can imagine once the quirks get worked out and it's a little bit more performant and consistent, it would be even better. So that's great. And Google is also making it easier for car manufacturers to integrate Android Automotive into their devices, into their cars. And they're going to make it easier for developers to adapt their apps for Android Automotive, which is the native operating system that's built into some of the cars, upcoming cars running Android. So there's only a handful of them out there. I think one of them is the Volvo XC60, as well as an upcoming BMW, and there's the Polestar 2. So there's only a few, but more are going to be launching with Android Automotive. Okay, Android TV with Google TV. This was a pretty minor announcement, but Google will be overhauling the remote app available for Android TV. So it's going to be a little bit more native. It's going to feel more modern. Not a ton of other updates to talk about there.
No, not really. Android TV didn't get a whole lot this year after getting the Google TV update in the fall.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff to do with conversations and Google Assistant. There's a new conversation AI that powers kind of back and forth. It's going to make Android Google Assistant a little bit more natural in its in the back and forth you have with it, which is great because my daughter's now discovering how to talk to what she calls Gable, And she really loves having these conversations, and they're pretty closed-ended because she doesn't really know the right words to ask, you know, to continue that conversation. So I'm excited about that. What else is interesting? Google Maps is getting a few updates. Ara, do you want to walk us through that?
Yeah, I liked the maps updates that we're getting because we're getting, they're adding in a bunch of new things for navigation modes. So you're going to be able to, it's going to be able to route you over the route that will take the least gas. There's also routing options that will be, okay, if you don't want to deal with heartbreaking situations as often, you can take the you can take a safer method of travel, which I'm just like, okay, I don't know what that route would actually be around Orlando, but I'm looking forward to finding out because I'm very much somebody who I don't like heartbreaking, like having to deal with just in general, like it's not great for the car, it's not great for your brakes, it's just not great overall. So I'm very happy for that. The eco routes is also fun. Another thing that is good for people who like live in cities and don't use cars as often is they're getting much more specific about where crosswalks are, where the individual lights are for more complicated intersections in big cities. So hopefully as that rolls out to more and more people, it'll be easier to navigate if, like, you're, say, visiting New York City or visiting Los Angeles and not renting a car, which I'm happy with.
Is Google going to be able to tell me when there's a bear in the road?
They said that they were going to be able to make it easier to route around, like, if there's like hazards in the road or if there's like right. really bad weather, it's supposed to be able to help use its like data points across the system and help you avoid those. And I'm just like,
well, how intensely
are y'all monitoring like all the roads everywhere?
Because that's an actual impressive conversation I had with my wife. There was no reason Waze couldn't do that. You could tell Waze, you remember Waze? Well, I think yeah. we all. You could tell it when there was a speed trap or there was a guy trying to change his car tire on the side of the road. She said, wouldn't it be great if it could, you could, you know, tell your Google Maps that there's a bear.
I'm just imagining that. I'm remembering that one episode of The Simpsons where there's like the bear patrol and it's like a stealth bomber yeah. flying overhead, you know, like keeping track of all the bears. I think that's definitely something Google could probably bring to fruition.
But Jerry, I mean, Google Maps does show you like speed traps and work zones these days. I mean, we've incorporated a lot of those Waze features in. Reporting them in Google Maps isn't as easy as it is in Waze, which is a shame because you should just be able to say, well, okay, gee, there's an accident ahead.
I think what Jerry's looking for is literally zooming out and just seeing all the bears in the continental United States.
Yeah. I mean, we track a fair number.
A bunch of red dots around my house, unfortunately.
So many of them have collars these days, right, with the tracking?
Sure, yes.
I guess in some places, yeah. Well, Google, there you go. Hire Era. She had a great idea for you.
No, that's not allowed. Sorry, Google. Okay, so some nice but not necessarily essential. There's some improvements to the AR walking mode as well in Google Maps, which is kind of neat.
I don't know how many of those, like the AR walking, like the live view walking stuff was new, because I feel like a lot of that got debuted last fall as well. I think they might have just expanded the areas that it's available in.
I don't know anybody nobody's left their house in a year, so maybe the AR, you know, features are not that widely used.
I swear
used.
I've written up that news post at least once or twice in the last 6 months.
It's saying that if you turn on live AR view, you'll be able to, quote, see restaurants and nearby businesses in relation to the hotel you're staying at, see interesting places close to your hotel, and it'll highlight relevant points of interest depending on the time of day. So like if it's breakfast time, AR view will highlight diners, blah, blah, blah. So kind
of
cool.
That's a natural evolution of what was that Google service that told you things that were
field
around
trip.
You? I'm pretty sure
it was Field Trip.
I don't remember what it was called, but that's what it did. When you brought it up, it just told you points of interest that were around you. This just feels like a natural evolution. It's like, okay, now let's mix that with Street View, and here's something that's really cool. So I'm interested in checking that out.
Let's talk about some Google Photos updates because there are quite a few. Google is using its machine learning prowess to identify patterns in objects in your photo roll. They're calling it Little Patterns, and it'll basically find similarities in many of the photos that you take, obviously with phones having larger storage capabilities and with cameras getting better over time, people are just taking more photos and they're using the burst mode to take a bunch of photos at once. Instead of taking a video, perhaps Google will be able to collate photos together into different categories. So you'll be able to see all of the coffee, you know, cups that you've taken photos of in a highlight, or you'll be able to
or the bears see, you've taken pictures of.
I'm just thinking of all the review pictures and I'm just like, oh, all my little patterns are going to be, here's all your Chromebook reviews, here are all your phone and case reviews. And I'm
all
just
of
like,
the phones eggs. That you've ever taken a photo of. One thing that's kind of interesting but a little creepy is that this is also going to apply to people. So if you take a bunch of photos of a person or a group of people at once and there's minor differences between those photos, Google will then combine them using neural networks to put them into, quote, cinematic moments. It'll actually apply movement, sort of like a deep fake. I think it will be neat, but it'll also probably be a little creepy at first, especially since that movement didn't actually exist.
Yeah, some serious nightmare fuel potential with that feature, I think, when you're looking at artificial movement between between still images.
It is also interesting that Google's doing this given that Pixel phones, iPhones, and Samsung phones, although it's off by default, use motion photos or live photos, whatever. So they often capture a little bit of video at the same time. And that's
saved. Yeah, on Pixels, this is going to look great because they'll just turn that on and just turn on the video.
Maybe. I don't know. But that's saved by default as a long press on the photos in Google Photos. So I'm not sure how this is going to look, but Google is also allowing people to hide individual photos from a memory. If for whatever reason you don't want that photo to show up anymore in a memory, you will be able to do that. You'll be able to hide specific dates or specific people from the memory, or just remove the memory altogether, which is great because Google should have allowed this from the beginning. Those memories are the ones that sort of float above. Those are highlights and give you, here's what happened on this date last year, or it groups a bunch of your friends together. I get this all the time. My daughter and my wife are a memory, a highlight that show up at the top of Google Photos. There's also going to be a locked folder in Google Photos. This is basically a porn mode. It'll let you hide your photos behind a biometric unlock or a pin. Samsung's offered this for years. Basically, every phone maker has offered this in their native gallery for years. This is not new, but it's coming to Google Photos, so yay.
Great for when you've taken a picture of that special gift that, you know,
I wanted to hide the dog from my children in my Google Photos, so I put it under a locked folder.
Yeah,
oh my God, okay. They had to stretch so hard to make that work.
One significant difference here, though, is this is across the web. It's not just a locked folder on your phone. Being part of Google Photos makes it infinitely more useful.
Sure.
If you want to share those photos of that dog, you don't want the rest of the world to see.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah. That'll be a great Google Photos link.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I really don't know how that sort of gets into the like Google Photos terms of use, but yeah, I guess that's, you know. If no one's asking any questions, then that's fine, I guess.
Let sleeping porn lie, I guess.
Yeah.
You can also, so Google is also introducing the ability to quickly delete the last 15 minutes of your search history. You know, if you accidentally search for, you know, puppies, you can quickly delete it if you don't want that showing up in your search history. It's just a single tap. And no more puppies in your search history.
But that doesn't hide it from your ISP or from the company that made your phone or any of that.
Well, then you need a good VPN, Jerry, because then your ISP won't be able
like
to see
our sponsor.
Like our sponsor, NordVPN, this week, which you either just heard or will hear, depending on what our producer, Jim, decides. So have fun with that. All right, that is Google Photos. I don't really want to get into the quantum computer stuff. I don't want to get into the new AI, you know, training model called MUM, which replaces BERT. I love these acronyms; they're amazing. But I do want to talk about Starline. Starline is super neat. They actually had a demo of this. It's basically a video conferencing tool that uses advanced 3D modeling and really high resolution cameras to reproduce somebody in front of you on a high resolution screen in a way that looks three dimensional. So they are
now. There's your future of porn, right there.
No, I was going to say that's VR, your holiday, but yeah. That's...
This looks wild. I mean, if you haven't seen the YouTube video that Google put together, go watch it.
I mean, I think that's on, you know, a lot of these things where, you know, especially VR, you can't really get a feel for how realistic it looks. When you see this in the IO keynote and you see the person looking at the display, it's like two people in the same room. And I think if you can, you know, if the depth effect is as good as it seems to be from, you know, the outside camera looking into this whole situation, then it's super impressive and, you know, a little bit eerie, a little bit scary.
I understand that. The thing about this was, so there, the video opens with sisters, one of whom has a new baby. One sister has never met the baby because they live on opposite sides of the country, and they're kind of looking at each other. And my heart was breaking because it looks so real. All you want is for them to be able to physically reach out and touch each other. And I think, look, I'm all for these advancements, but it kills me that it's going to make it even more apparent that you're not in the same place. Maybe just right now I'm super sensitive to that because I've been talking to family over Zoom for the last year, and it just feels...
You're thinking there's kind of like an uncanny valley in terms of like presence?
Yeah.
The same like way there is for, you know, like human... you know, like human likenesses.
It's tricking your brain even more than usual to make it think that there is somebody physically in front of you. And like in VR, when you reach out and that thing is not real... It has an emotion. Your body has a natural emotional response to it that you don't get from a 2D screen.
And especially if it's a family member, it's someone you care about, right? That's
right.
The feel, yeah.
I'm not saying at all this is a bad thing. Obviously, this is not going to be widely available for many, many more years. But it does just bring up that idea that like physical presence, physical touch is so much a part of physical presence, and emulating that might have adverse effects for some people. So,
and I think the uncanny valley thing is probably an apt sort of comparison, because as it, you know, everyone's used to placing a Zoom call or whatever and seeing someone, and you know, it's a bit grainy or whatever, you know, it's a 2D image of someone that you're looking at, you can kind of communicate, but you're both people on both sides of the call are aware of the limitations there. As it becomes closer to being you in the same room as someone else, whether it's, you know, high resolution, perception of depth, that kind of stuff. I think it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, the changes in our perception sort of manifest with that, because, you know, it's as you get closer to sort of reality, you, as you say, you are more aware of the fact that, you know, although it looks like they're there, you're very much aware of the fact that they're not there.
Mm-hmm. I likened it to, you know, not that I doubt most of the people listening have ever experienced this. I know I haven't, but you see it on TV when you're talking to someone who's in prison.
Yes, that was exactly my thought when I first saw this. I'm like, this is like those teleconferencing things for jail, but how it should actually look instead of those piece of crap systems that they actually have.
Yeah, but you're still not really there. It's, I don't know. I didn't like it. I think the technology's neat, but I'm with Daniel. This would bother me more than not having it.
I mean, I think that's part of the reason that they're testing this for like enterprise situations where it'll cut down on business trips, that you still get more of the feeling of like being in the room and making a deal with someone.
Right. But it's interesting that they conveyed it in the most emotional way possible. Yes. They didn't just show a bunch of coworkers from across the country talking shop, because that would not have had the same effect.
There's nothing sexy about that.
Of course not.
I talk with my granddaughter over, you know, Google Meet at least once a week. every single time, I wish I could just walk over there and pick her up and set her on my lap and read her a story. And I can't. I know I can't. This would make that feeling even worse.
Yeah. All right. What else didn't we talk about from I.O.?
I kind of like the stuff for Google Workspaces, most importantly being that more people are going to be able to use Google Workspaces because it's not going to be just the paid features for the paid accounts anymore.
All right, walk us through that, because there's this Smart Canvas thing as well that'll bring Meet calls into your spreadsheets. Not a big fan of that, but it was inevitable. What else?
Google Docs is getting a pageless format, and I am so freaking happy. Like, I love Google Docs. I do a lot of writing in Google Docs. I hate that it is still using that 8 by 11 and a half page layout. Like, that is so last century, guys. This is, we write on the web. We write for the web. I don't need to see how many pages it would be. And I don't need to keep that window full width in order to see the full length of what I'm, the full words of what I'm writing or what I'm referencing. So that made me just so happy. Like, being able to tag people, being able to add, like, emoji reactions when you're commenting on somebody else's document, that's fine. Being able to start a Google Meet from within, like, we could open up the our video call in order to do the podcast from the show notes whenever this thing goes live. Not that we would, because that's just going to be janky as all get out, but anything that helps make work easier and makes part of what I liked about Smart Canvas is it makes it more adaptable, which is great for people who don't work at a desk, sitting in front of like one or two screens where everything can be on its own monitor. Like Google Workspaces needs to work on whatever device I have handy.
This podcast is actually a Google Doc.
I just hope this doesn't break anything. There's a lot of stuff here that I would have no use for day to day. I know a lot of people do, but I don't want it to break what I need to work every day. And this is Google. That always worries me.
And there's a lot of stuff in this that seemed very sort of pie in the sky. Like, you know, the obvious comparison was Google Wave, right? From like 10, 11 years ago.
Thank God I'm not also, the only one who thought of that.
Yeah. And also, you know, from any one of the number of failed Google messaging products throughout the years, that's the obvious comparison. And also just there's the fact that Google in general doesn't have a great track record with showing whizbang features at I/O and actually bringing them to fruition. The obvious one, I guess the most direct one aside from Wave is I can't even remember. I guess it was Hangouts, right? That they tried to turn into like a Slack replacement that just never actually happened. This strikes me as the latest iteration of that, you know, call it Google Wave, call it whatever. I'll believe it when I see it.
I think that the, you know, collaboration combined with task management combined with better ways to have meetings, this is a good thing. And I understand that Google wanted to try to build that out.
Fool me once, Jerry. Fool me once.
But this would be better as a separate product. Don't mess with Google Docs the way it stands, because I think what's so good about Google Docs or Google Sheets is its simplicity.
Yeah, but we also know what happens when Google has multiple products with the same purpose.
Yeah.
Like, Google has a thing about that, so I'm very happy that they're just implementing it or making them options in the current products instead of trying to reinvent everything and have the new features there. Like this, I'd much prefer what we have here as opposed to an inbox versus Gmail situation, because eventually inbox dies and everybody who used it is sad.
Yeah, I mean, Google's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? If they make it a new product, then, you know, the track record is not good there. If they incorporate into an existing product, then, you know, they're open to accusations of cluttering up an already beloved product with extra cruft that probably most people don't care about. So, I don't know. Give it time, I guess.
Does this mean Google Jamboard is finally going to die?
I'm just excited to, instead of editing my colleague's work, I'll just be able to leave emojis with down-facing thumb every time I don't like a sentence. And they'll just have to guess what I'm referring to. So, have fun with that. I don't know. I agree with this. Like, Google needs some way to tie Workspace, Docs, whatever, together. and launch a project management style system. You know, we use external, we use Workspace for everything, but we have our Trello, Airtable style management system that's completely separate. And right now, Google has nothing to compete with the Asanas and SAPs of the world when it comes to project management. And I think that's what this is eventually going to turn into.
Well, so, it's funny you mentioned Asana. Asana and what Google showed us are like the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. Like you said, I can see, you know, Smart Canvas, whatever they're going to brand this as, being a bunch of thumbs down emojis. Whereas, you know, Asana is an actual enterprise, companies really need that. So hopefully it's more than just a casual product. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. You understand what I mean, right?
Yeah, but I mean, again, like right now, we live in Google Calendar, we live in Google Meet, but we use Slack, we use Airtable. And I think eventually Google is going to understand that to compete with those companies, it's going to need to build features that over that live sort of in the room above Google Docs and Google Sheets and Google Meet.
I mean, they need a version of Google Classroom for the real world and for actual work, yeah, instead of just courses.
I was going to say, I hate to say it, but the space above that is messaging. And we all know how
we
that's
all
gone.
Know how that,
yeah.
Man. Yeah, let's leave that for another episode. All right. I think we're going to leave it there from a IO perspective. There was a lot more, and we will have much more on the site. And if there's anything in the last couple of days that we find, we will talk about it on next week's show, but we will be right back with what's making us happy. And then we'll let you enjoy your weekend. All right. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by NordVPN. You have heard tons of people tell you why it's important to use a VPN, both on your phone and your laptop. The TLDR is that it encrypts your data between your device, the phone or laptop, and the eventual destination where your data is going. So if that app or service is using weak or no encryption, there's a potential for it to be intercepted or used by malicious actors. VPNs stand in the middle of that and ensure that traffic is routed securely and using extremely high encryption so that nobody is going to be able to use your data in ways that you don't want. NordVPN is one of the fastest and easiest to use VPN services out there. It's available on mobile, on desktop, and everywhere else in between. And it is one that we here at Android Central actually recommend. If you go to our best VPN roundup, we've used it and we really like it. So yes, they are sponsoring the show, but we actually use it a lot. And it's one that I've personally used for a long time. So what I would like you to do is, if you are interested, you can go to nordvpn.com/ACP for 66% off a 2-year plan plus a free month. So that is 25 months and you get 66% off the total amount. That equates to $3.96 per month for NordVPN in the US, 66% off globally, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee if you're not happy. That is really cheap and you have no commitments because you'll get your money back. So again, go to NordVPN, that's nordvpn.com/ACP. Use our code, get 66% off the 2-year plan, and you get a free month included in that as well. Try it, see how you like it, let us know. Okay, I say weekend, really hoping that you're listening to this on a Friday, but you may actually listen to it on a Thursday. I get people messaging me every Friday saying, where's the podcast? Where's the podcast? The last 3 weeks, it's come out on Sunday, and last week, this week, I guess, came out on Monday because we've just been really busy and only had time to record on Fridays. But our goal is always to publish on Wednesday so that it comes out Thursday or Friday. That is the goal, and we try to stick to it. So I really am sorry that everybody who's wanted to listen to it on the weekend has had to wait until Sunday or Monday. We will try to do better. Speaking of better, Alex Dobie, what is making you happy this week?
So for this week, I'm kind of going back to sort of highlighting YouTube creators that are making me happy. This week, I want to highlight a channel called Ordinary Things. I don't know if anyone else is familiar with that. It's a British guy essentially explaining stuff, anything from Windows to fedoras to onions, neckties, offices, hell, vaping. Essentially, it's
hell or vaping.
What makes this channel is not just the guy's delivery, his performance, but also the writing. It's essentially a one man band. But it's very entertaining stuff. I think if anyone's in the UK and is familiar with Charlie Brooker's stuff, everyone knows Charlie Brooker from his work on Black Mirror. Before that, he did a bunch of stuff for the BBC. This is kind of in a similar sort of vein, in that sort of satirical, almost documentary-ish style. So just search Ordinary Things on YouTube. You'll find a bunch of stuff on there. Very, very, very entertaining. Satirical kind of stuff. For a one-man band, very, very well-produced stuff.
All right, that is Ordinary Things on YouTube. Thank you, Alex. Ara, what's making you happy this week?
Google Maps location sharing, because I have been seeing my mom go crisscross the Magic Kingdom today, because my mom's in town and she's at the park and I am working, so I am living vicariously through her.
Okay, that is a very pointed criticism of you having to work on a Wednesday. So
hey, now I knew this was going to work. I booked her. We booked her trip before Google I/O got announced, because I was like, "Oh, Google I/O will be at the beginning of the month."
Blame JK. Google, not me, Ara. This is Google's fault.
Oh, I totally blame Google. Like, Google has kept I/O like the same week for almost a decade. Like, why did they make it late this year?
Yeah.
Why?
They're worried about rain, obviously, in California. Jerry, what's making you happy this week?
I picked up an old orange tube, well, not too old, orange tube amp at the pawn shop. I actually traded it for my Fender amp. And I don't know, I assume some people listening to this play guitar. And I forgot just how cool that sounds. I'm not going to lie. It makes me sound like I know what I'm doing when it comes to playing a guitar. It's just, I don't know, I get that cool vintage crunchy sound without all these big fancy electronics in there. And it didn't cost me a penny, and that's always a big plus for me. And I don't know, I like it. It's okay for me to like it. I'm just that kind of guy. I miss Hayato because I wanted to talk to him about it, and he's busy.
He is busy. Yeah, well, I'll talk to you about it. I don't know anything about guitar amps, but I do love crunchy guitar in general, so I'd listen to you wail on an electric guitar.
Well, you say
guitar.
That now, but it's I don't know. It's an old sound. Let's just stop there. It's an old sound. I guess that means I'm an old person, but I love the sound, and I love how easy it is to get that sound without spending a bunch of money on equipment.
You're well aged. You're not
there
old.
You go.
You're well aged. All right. Well, what's making me happy this week? I spent the last few days working on an iPad Pro review for iMore, which is sort of my second job. Occasionally, Apple sends me stuff to review. This is interesting because it's the M1 iPad Pro. It's got a mini LED display. It's an iPad, and it does iPad things, but the tech in this thing is remarkable. And yesterday, I was also given a code to Divinity Original Sin, Divinity 2 Original Sin, and I got to play that really like famous RPG for a couple of hours, and I I played it with my DualSense controller. Divinity Original Sin 2. It came out in 2017 for PC, came out for console a couple years later. This is a full console quality RPG available on exclusively on the iPad. iOS 14.5 lets you play with DualSense and Xbox controllers. The screen's amazing. I just jammed out on this thing for a while. It really does feel like you're playing on a PlayStation 5 or an Xbox. I don't know. I talked in the review about how it's ridiculous that we have to wait for these AAA titles to be released on the Play Store because you can't use Game Pass or Stadia easily on iOS. But when you do get a taste of the kind of console quality graphics that an M1 can produce on a screen this good with a controller, it just feels like there it is. Like it's that like Jeff Goldblum, there it is GIF. And it's just, it's wild. And I really enjoyed it. So that's Divinity Original Sin 2 on the iPad Pro. And if you want to go read the review, it's on iMore right now.
See, that makes it, I can't wait until they, you know, make an M1 Mac Pro with discrete GPU support. And maybe Macs can become regular PC gaming platforms again.
Eventually, maybe. I mean, there's so much stuff happening in emulation right now.
Yeah, way back when, the Mac, if you remember, was the original PC gaming platform.
Yep.
You know,
before DirectX. So, I mean, Microsoft pulled off a coup with DirectX, and that was basically...
Put your big floppy disks in your Apple IIe and play Frogger or whatever.
Now you're really well-aged. Damn. All right. Well, that is our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check us out on Twitter, Jerry is at GB Hill. Ara is at Ara Wagco. Alex is at Alex Dobie. I'm at Journey Dan. We'll be back hopefully next Thursday, Friday with another episode tying up the loose ends of Google I/O and reporting on whatever is interesting in the world of Android. Until then, thank you for listening and have a great week. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye.
Adios.